What a year. What a year it's been for all of us. And it's far from over. I have the sense, and I'm sure some of the rest of you do as well, that it's all kind of headed for some great sort of culmination or climax, probably with the election that's going to happen in a couple of weeks. Recently, Noam Chomsky, who's one of my intellectual heroes, said that we are now living through the most dangerous moment in human history. If that seems hyperbole, can you think of a more dangerous moment for our human civilization? I can't. He particularly cited the climate crisis, the threat of nuclear war, which we sometimes tend to forget about, but it's still very real, and also rising authoritarianism. But there's so many other issues that we could add that make this such a dangerous time. First of all, COVID, of course, but all of the other things that COVID has brought with it, including sort of economic breakdown. Think of what it's meant for education, whether to have online or in-person schooling. Think of the additional mental stress, mental illness, the way it's aggravated the gap between rich and poor, which was already obscene, and so forth. I mean, social polarization, Black Lives Matter, greater racial tensions, and so forth. And now this November election, in which many of these issues are at stake, maybe even the future of our democracy. So anyway, no wonder so many of us are anxious these days. Yes, we have a lot to be anxious about. I notice some people are avoiding the news altogether. Others, frankly, like me, sort of can't turn away from it for very long. And others, I've noticed, are actually doing a better job of rationing themselves. There are some people that, you know, basically refuse to watch any news after noon. But in any case, I think we need to remember what the Dalai Lama has said, quote, "Every individual has a responsibility to help guide our global family in the right direction. Good wishes aren't sufficient. We must become actively engaged." A student once asked Zen master Unman, "What is the goal of a lifetime of practice?" And Unman replied, "An appropriate response." I mean, it's clear our Buddhist path isn't about avoiding difficult situations, but how do we respond appropriately to such a formidable array of challenges, right? What should we be doing? Buddhist teachings have always emphasized impermanence. And you could say that from a Buddhist perspective, our world isn't a collection of separate things, but rather a confluence of processes. Some of them are slow, some of them are fast, but basically it's processes working together. And in any case, impermanence certainly seems to be a good description of this last year. The world that so many of us took for granted has suddenly turned quite unstable, and the future too looks more uncertain than ever before. I mean, it's not that we want to return to some old normal, which was never that good for most people to begin with, and certainly not for the biosphere. But it's also looking doubtful that there's going to be anything like a new normal in terms of sort of settling down in the foreseeable or the very near future. It seems like we're in for a really wild ride, such as the start of this year, and may go on for quite a while. A ride that I think is already testing the maturity of our practice and testing how well have we integrated the insights that Buddhism offers us. One teaching that is all the more relevant today, and it's the one that I want to focus on this evening, is what's sometimes called don't know mind, which, however, is easy to misunderstand. It doesn't imply willful ignorance about what's happening or lack of concern for what's going on, or evading responsibility in any way. On the contrary, we need to keep abreast of what's going on, what's happening, in order to respond appropriately. But rather, don't know mind involves letting go of our fixed ideas about the world, including ourselves and our expectations about what's happening, what's possible, and indeed, our expectations about who we are. And there's some very well-known Zen stories that talk about this don't know mind. One of the most famous actually goes back to the supposed founder of Zen in China, Bodhidharma. Supposedly, he's the guy who brought the Buddhist teaching from India. He was like the 28th successor of the Buddha, came to China and became the first Zen patriarch. And it's probably all mythology, but anyway, it's a great story. After he came to China, he was interviewed by the emperor, Emperor Wu, who asked him, "What's the ultimate meaning of the holy truth of Buddhism?" And Bodhidharma replied, "Vast emptiness, nothing holy, no holiness." Taken aback, the emperor asked, "Who is it here that is standing before me?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." The emperor was baffled, but Bodhidharma then left and went off to do some more meditation. As many people have pointed out, Bodhidharma's "I don't know" isn't our usual or ordinary "I don't know." The point here being that when we understand ourselves, when we understand ourselves, you could say we're objectifying ourselves to ourselves. And in the process, we're overlooking something important about what my Zen master used to call our true nature or our essential nature, that it's unfixed, it's non-objectifiable, right? You could say that don't know mind isn't a place where we reside, but something like a pure potentiality. But that potentiality is lost, or it becomes limited when we're fixated on ideas, again, of who we are, of our expectations, right? I appreciated that poem that David read earlier. I think it was clearly designed with this talk in mind, right? Don't know mind, because the last line was, right? Rilke says, "I don't know. Am I a falcon? Am I a growing storm? Or am I a great poem?" This "I don't know," I think it's the same spirit, something very deep there that, in the deepest sense, there's something essentially mysterious, unknowable about who we are and our potentialities. Yeah. There's another classical Zen story about not knowing, where Master Jizo asked Hogen. Hogen is this guy who sort of, he's a very advanced practitioner, but he's been wandering around as they were supposed to do, or often did after their formal training. Anyway, Jizo asked Hogen, "Where have you come from?" "Well, I'm wandering around on pilgrimage," replied Hogen. "Why are you on pilgrimage?" asked Jizo. "I don't know," replied Hogen. "Ah, not knowing is most intimate." At that, Hogen experienced great enlightenment. Domyo Burke, a Zen teacher, wrote about this. Hogen awakens at Master Jizo's comment, not because he suddenly realizes why he's been wandering so long and practicing so hard, and not because he finally conceives what he's been looking for. Rather, he momentarily drops all of his preconceived notions. And at that moment, there's only his body, mind, Master Jizo's compassion, the sandals on his feet, the cicadas buzzing in the trees. Right there, in this direct experience of his life, the meaning of it all becomes clear. Without conception, definition, description, or knowing of any kind. But again, what is that meaning that becomes clear? My own Zen master, Yamada Roshi, wrote about this in response, like In Zen, the Dharma talks tend to be commentaries on koans, these paradoxical questions. And he was giving a commentary on this case 16 of the Gateless Gate, where Unman says, same Unman, by the way, says, "The world is vast and wide like this. Why do we put on our robe at the sound of the bell? Why do we do that?" And in his commentary, Yamada Roshi puts it well, huh? "You will realize that when you put on your robe, there is no reason or why in it. Why do you put on a suit and go out at 8 o'clock every morning?" Well, he was a Japanese businessman, right? So, "Why do you eat lunch at noon? Why do you go to bed at 10 in the evening? Why? Try to search out this why. There is no reason for the why in anything. When we stand up, there's no reason why. We just stand up. When we eat, we just eat without any reason why. When we put on the robe, we just put it on. Our life is a continuous just. And in Japanese, the term tada, just this, very similar to the original Buddhist term, tatha, just this, huh? Just this. Now, I know that might sound a little odd, a little strange. I mean, obviously, there's lots of whys in our lives. But what he's getting at here is, for example, washing dishes. Why do I wash the dishes after dinner? You can say, well, I wash the dishes because they start smelling and they can cause infection and so forth. Or I wash the dishes because my wife wants me to, or I wash the dishes because TV's waiting. But, you know, ultimately the idea is, okay, the dishes need to be washed, granted. But when I'm washing the dishes, why do I wash the dishes? There's just the washing of the dishes. There's just this. You can let go of the why. You just do it. Just this. Ta-da. Right? That, I think, is pointing at don't know mind. Just this. No why. Now, here's the interesting question. For me, getting back to this year of our lives, this really challenging moment that Chomsky talks about, what does this don't know mind mean for social engagement? What does it mean for how we respond appropriately to all of these challenges? It's interesting that don't know mind is the first tenet of the Zen peacemaker movement, which is in many ways probably the single most important sort of Zen organization dealing with social engagement, right? So not knowing is the first tenet. The second one being bearing witness to the joys and sufferings of the world. And then third, taking action that arises from not knowing and bearing witness. One of the members of the Zen Peacemakers, the Roshi or Zen Master at ZCLA, Zen Center of Los Angeles, she describes not knowing in a very good way, I think. She calls it, quote, "A flash of openness or a sudden shift to being present in the moment in which we take shelter in," I don't like take shelter in, I would say open up to, "in which we open up to the place before anything arises, a place of emptiness and profound silence. We become more spacious, more aware of our own reactivity, and so we're less likely to get caught up in that, and more open to the perspectives of others. Thus, this kind of not knowing, it's not a fixed position, but a way of engaging with the world just as it is right here and now. We don't know what's going to happen next, but we do the best we can according to what we can see, ready to change what we're doing as the situation or our understanding of the situation changes, right? Understood in this way, don't know mind points to what I think is the most distinctive and powerful aspect of spiritual activism or bodhisattva activism, social activism. Why it is that bodhisattvas can act without attachment to the results of their actions. And here I want to apologize if you've heard me talk about this before, but I think this is such an important principle, and Don't Know Mind illuminates it or ties up with it so well, right? The Buddha in the Pali Canon, he actually says that one characteristic of awakened people is that what they do is nirasa, a Pali term variously translated as desireless or without expectation, sometimes even without hope. I mean, they're in Don't Know Mind. Aphorisms in the Tibetan Lojong say the same sort of thing. Quote, abandon hope of fruition. Don't get caught up in how you're going to be in the future. Stay in the present moment. In which case you can act, you do act out of Don't Know Mind. And this principle is also an essential aspect of karma yoga, right? That one of those important teachings that the Bhagavad Gita, that most important Hindu text, talks about, where it says, your right is to the work, never to the fruits. Yeah. So acting without attachment is possible when we're in Don't Know Mind. But still, there's a danger here in that it can be understood, Don't Know Mind can be understood to kind of imply a very casual attitude about consequences in particular. And I think this is especially true because Buddhism places so much emphasis on our motivation, on our intention, and we can sometimes think, well, that's the only important thing, right? What's important is my attention, not the result, which in fact, I think is a big misunderstanding of what's going on here, a big misunderstanding of Don't Know Mind. Zen practitioners, again, I guess this is kind of a Zen talk this evening, we often recite, in fact, every day, really, the four bodhisattva vows. And the first of those is to help all living beings awaken, right? So one translation, well, in Japanese, shujo muhen seigan do. Living beings are numberless. I vow to liberate them all, or to help them all wake up. If we really understand what this commitment involves, I mean, it's pretty overwhelming, right? We're vowing to accomplish something that kind of by definition can't be accomplished, right? Can't be fulfilled. So of course, what the vow is really pointing at is not so much a goal, but a kind of basic reorientation in the meaning of our lives, away from our usual self preoccupation, you know, to asking, you know, what can I do, you know, to make this world or this situation better for everyone. So on a day-to-day level, what becomes important is not that goal, that unattainable goal of helping everyone when you've helped everyone awaken and you've achieved your goal, but rather it's the direction of one's efforts, a direction that orients us without providing any endpoint. And again, Don't Know Mind. Another Zen story, a student asked Joshu, what is the fact that I accept responsibility for? And Joshu said, to the end of time, you will never single it out. Why won't you single it out? Because there's no particular thing that you accept responsibility for, right? The vow goes beyond attachment to any particular accomplishment or failure, right? It involves cultivating this new way of being in the world, which again is embodying Don't Know Mind, because the focus is not on some final goal. Yeah. And this therefore doesn't, you know, when we understand the Don't Know Mind aspect of it, it helps us understand why this new way of being doesn't necessarily imply being optimistic or even hopeful, right? The problem is that both of them are dualistic in the sense that, you know, the other side of hope is fear or even despair. It's like the whole meaning of hope is the negation of fear. And what that really means is to cling to hope is also to be shadowed or even haunted by its opposite, which is fear, which is always there kind of to pounce on us if we ever let go of that hope. I remember one of my teachers, Robert Aiken Roshi in Hawaii, liked to say, when there's hope, there's no hope. When there's no hope, there's hope. Ah, these Zen puzzles, right? Again, the idea that when we're embodying don't know mind, bodhisattvas, or I would say any socially engaged practitioner, we're moved to act by something deeper than hope or fear, or you know, that duality of hope and fear, or optimism, pessimism, right? We're moved to act by a compassionate generosity of spirit that naturally just wants to express itself. And although it seeks results, it's not as though you're indifferent to results. You seek results, but it doesn't require them. I hope this makes some sense, because it points to the profound connection between don't know mind and non-attachment to results. I think Wendell Berry put it very well, and I may have quoted him last time as well. We don't have the right to ask whether we're going to succeed or not. The only question we have the right to ask is, what's the right thing to do? That's don't know mind. Our task is to do the very best thing we can, the best we can, the right thing to do, without knowing, without being able to know what the consequences will be, never knowing if our efforts are going to make any difference whatsoever. So if we think about the November election, which so many of us are concerned about, you know, some of us are knocking on doors, some of us are making phone calls or sending postcards. Will that make any difference whatsoever? I don't know. We don't know. We can't know, right? Will the uncounted postal ballots lead to chaos on election day and afterwards? We don't know, and that's okay. Of course, it's our intention that the work will bear fruit, that will have some impact. That's the reason we vote ourselves, right? So there is a kind of strategic element to it. It's not just a kind of an act that symbolic and it doesn't matter. You know, there is the intention that something will come out of it. But ultimately, our appropriate response to the challenge of these times is really a kind of gift out of our generous nature, that kind of generous nature that David talked about when he talked about Dana, the Dana process, right? A generosity that expresses itself in what we do and how we relate to other people and to the world. And again, that calling it a gift, the whole point of that is that if something is a gift, if it's a genuine gift, we don't expect something in return. It's freely given, as David said. So we can't know if what we do is important, but we do know that, we can know that in these critical times, it is important for us to do it, to do what we can. Not only in regard to the election, but in general to the kind of crucial time, dangerous time that Chomsky referred to. Of course, to be completely unattached to the results of our efforts, I mean, that's setting the bar pretty high. And that's okay too. You know, frankly, as you've probably guessed, if Trump is somehow reelected, I will be quite disappointed. And it's going to affect my mood for some time. But the important point is, regardless of what happens, because of our practice, because of our ability in our practice to let go and cultivate this don't know mind, regardless of what we may feel in response, we don't get stuck there, right? Our job isn't to be perfect, but to do what we can. And thank goodness for this meditative practice that we have that can help us. It may take a while, but it can help us sort of open up and return to that don't know mind. When things don't work out, we might be discouraged, but thanks to those practices, we don't get stuck there. We might need a few mindful breaths or even a bit more than that, but don't know mind is always accessible. It's always there. It's always what there is whenever or as soon as we're able to let go and open up to it. Does this make any sense? I guess I need a few nods from people, a little bit of feedback here. Yeah. I would like to conclude by offering or doing together a kind of three-part reflection, you know. And where this comes from is people sometimes ask me, you know, they especially Buddhist practitioners, you know, we have the tradition where the focus is on our meditative cushion, especially in Zen. It's very clear, you know, a lot, it's often been viewed that to get off your cushion and to become socially engaged is a real distraction from the main practice. And we're only slowly waking up to the realization that our engagement is just as important a part of our practice as whatever is going on, you know, on our cushions. But still people, they don't know what to do and they don't know what to start, where to start, how to start. So what's occurred to me is a kind of a three-part reflection that I'd like to share with you. And we don't really have time this evening to go into sort of the time that's really needed to do it fully. In fact, I think that would be quite a bit of time, you know, maybe days. But I would like to share the fundamental idea with you here, because I personally have found it very helpful, and other people have told me that. This three-part reflection or contemplation for aspiring bodhisattvas, if you want to call it that, right? So, a reflection in three stages on three different issues. First of all, if we want to become engaged, starting with ourselves, reflecting on who we are, and again, not in a way that negates don't know mind, but still having some realistic sense of what our potential is. In other words, you know, taking account of our age, our, you know, one's age, one's health, one's gender, one's education, one's skills, one's networks of friends, and one's resources that you have access to. Might be one's race, one's nationality, but just sort of do a kind of a self-accounting in order to get a sense of, you know, what do I really have to offer that's distinctive and might really be very helpful? That would be the first one. So if we can just take a moment to just reflect on that. What do you bring? What do you have to offer? The second stage is to reflect, you know, if the first stage is sort of looking at yourself, the second stage is turning outward and looking into, inquiring into the possibilities that are available to me to act. You know, what presents itself? I mean, obviously, for example, here in Colorado, those of us who are very concerned about ecological issues are very concerned about fracking. That's a major issue that many of us have worked on. And, you know, also in Colorado, we have Extinction Rebellion groups in Denver and on the Front Range. So that's a possibility. There's 350.org. At this particular point, of course, given the election, there's an awful lot that can be done in relationship to the election, especially, you know, getting out the vote. So those are just a few examples. And, you know, given the way that we're networked now and in communication with so many people in so many places, it might not only be physically locally, but it also could be very broad, right? An obvious example there is, you know, there's an awful lot of groups that need financial support. There's so much poverty. There's so much need. So obviously, that's something we can do, and it doesn't have to be local. It can be local. I think of, you know, because of so many people losing their jobs, the need of food banks is huge. So that's somewhere, not only donating food, but money, but it also might be to some organization that's dealing with poverty overseas and helping people who don't even live in the US at all. So just as an example, but to reiterate the basic point in this second reflection, what are the possibilities out here where I might be able to act? So let's just take another little pause and just reflect on that for a moment. The third reflection is, for me, probably the most important one. Having done the first two, having done that kind of self-accounting or self-evaluation, and, you know, turned inside, looked at that, turned outside, looked at what's possible, what's needed. In the third stage, having assimilated those first two, having done them well, now forget them completely. Let go of them completely. And this requires a deeper kind of meditation. What tugs at our heart? Really getting in touch. Again, deeper than ego, deeper than our usual sense of choosing, but where does our love, where does our compassion, where does our dana, generosity, where does it want to go? How does it want to express itself? As I say, you know, this isn't just a matter of making a list here. It really involves, I think, the deeper meditation of sort of really taking the time. In other words, what do we really want to do? Given our finitude, given our possibilities, what do we want to do with the time remaining for us on this earth? Or at least, I mean, not even thinking about the time, but right now, embodying don't know mind. What does don't know mind, how does it want to respond appropriately right here and now? What calls to us from beyond ourselves, in a way. It's something deeper than our usual way of thinking about it. It's getting in touch with that. I think you can see what I'm getting at here now, and I think you can also sense that this isn't the kind of thing we can do just in one session, even if we took a whole session to do it. But I've found it very helpful. And as I said, others, I mean, one could easily take a whole week for each of those stages or more. And I think it's sometimes especially something good to do, that third stage in particular, during some kind of self-retreat or meditative retreat. But this is something that I would sort of encourage everyone to sort of, I don't know how important it is to do this in a formal way, but in a way, I think all three of those are factors or issues or concerns that we need to take account of when we ask ourselves this extremely important, enormously important question, right? Given that this is the most dangerous time in human history, what does it mean for me and for us to respond appropriately? I think that's a challenge that we can't evade, and it's the real test of the maturity of our practice and our Buddhist path. So let me leave it at that. Thank you.